Hello, I'm Robert Bound, and this is The Big Interview on Monocle 24. My guest today is David Putnam, a legend of the British and international film industry. As an independent film producer, Putnam has made a string of award-winning hit films, including The Mission, The Killing Fields, Local Hero, Chariots of Fire, Midnight Express, and Bugsy Malone. His films have won 10 Oscars, 25 BAFTAs, and the Palme d'Or at Cannes. Born in working-class London during the Second World War, Putnam didn't meet his father until he was 5 years old, but credits both of his parents as being inspirational characters who gave him the wings to fly, first in advertising, then in film. Putnam has chaired and campaigned extensively for organisations promoting education, climate change responsibility, and public service broadcasting. He was awarded a CBE in 1982, a knighthood in 1995, and appointed to the House of Lords in 1997, where he sits on the Labour benches. And Lord Putnam joins me here today at Midori House in London. David, Lord Putnam, thank you very much for joining us. First of all, there are so many things, as we've just heard, on the roster that runs through such a rich life. But I'd like to start, actually, in your career in film, long career in film, and as a super producer. People will kind of know the term producer. They might sometimes get it confused with director or all these other things. Maybe let's try to define what a producer does, because the producer, unfortunately, is the person whose phone never stops ringing, not always in a good way, who has to lash this whole ship together to make it seaworthy. Maybe you can define what some of the key aspects of your role as a producer have been.
Yes, it's a nice opportunity in a way, because I feel very passionately about what a producer is and indeed what a producer isn't, because I see increasingly these credits on movies with reels and reels and reels of executive producers and whatever. I don't know what they do. I have no idea. I suppose at some point they've probably been engaged in some aspect of either the development of the property or maybe the funding. But for me, a producer is the person who's central to the process. The only way I've ever explained it, I think, adequately, certainly to my own students, is that the director's responsible for everything the camera sees, including, for the most part, the cast. The producer is responsible for pretty well everything else, including the director. And one of the reasons I was able to define that for myself was that 90% of the movies that I produced started with me, i.e. that I conceived them or I purchased the original material. So I was the film's father, and very happy to acknowledge that the director was the film's mother. But the idea that a film gets made irrespective of who produces it is ridiculous.
And a producer is, as you say, you're the film's father. You're the person that sort of sets out with the vision for it. You
provide the resources.
So that's getting the money together. That's getting the studio. That's presumably, at the bottom line, hiring the director and the actors and all the things that you see that end up on the screen. That's your job.
Yeah, the two crucial decisions to make as a producer is obviously choice of material, but other than that, a choice of screenwriter, and then, of course, the choice of director. Get those wrong, and you've got either no film at all or a very, very bad film. You know, the director's responsible for his work for cooking the children's food every day putting them to bed at night and making sure that the family, the movie family, grows up and flourishes. But the family, the resourcing of the family, and the holding the family together essentially is the role of the producer.
And does it feel like a family enterprise when you do it? I mean, listeners will obviously know your name in conjunction with so many of these wonderful movies, The Killing Fields, The Mission, Chariots of Fire, Oscar-winning, BAFTA-winning, huge, grossing, successful films that are part of the international film consciousness, which is quite an amazing feat to do, to bore down into people's reality and sort of show them a truth that they didn't know before is quite an amazing thing to have done. However, it all looks hunky-dory when we watch it back in the cinema. But in the making of those films, does it feel like a family when you're working with directors and leading lights and all the rest of it? Or does it very much feel like a business at that point, I wonder?
No, I think the only thing that I miss from the film industry, and I mean the only thing I miss, is that sense of collegiality. When you're making a film and that film's going well, it is it's being part of a very beautiful machine. And it is a family, you're quite right. I mean, in my own family, I know, in a sense, suffered a little bit, but very good about it. They knew that when I was making a movie, during the process of making a film, in a sense, they had to take a secondary role. My wife, very intelligently, very early on, said, "I'm not going to visit you on set. It's because that's your world. It's another world. And I come in, I'm an alien." Yeah, there is something very, very beautiful about being part of a successful creative enterprise. I think it's true of creativity in general. I mean, architects would probably tell you the same thing. It's very special, and it's the only aspect I miss.
And there's one of those things, I suppose, on a film set, as you say, with any creative enterprise, people are pushed together in a short amount of time to do something that has to look good, but it has to be successful. So there are all sorts of fast friendships presumably made. It seems like you're rare in the sense that you've kept a lot of friends in that industry, and that people, you know, in order, a producer is the kind of person that most people have to be begrudgingly respectful of, rather than actually have a great deal of lasting friendship and passion for. What's the secret? I wonder if that goes back to your childhood, whether it goes back to how you did business when you were a young man. Are there traces of it, do you think, in the way you operate?
The only trace I can... There's two important ones, really, two strands. One is that as a child, both at home and to a very great degree at school, I learned to be a peacemaker. I was not a big kid. I was able to be quite funny. And, you know, there were warring factions at school, as there are indeed in every school. And to an extent, looking back, I was the peacemaker. I was the guy that said to the bully, you know, don't do that. You're actually nicer than that. And to the kid that had been oppressed, look, you mustn't be frightened of him. So, yeah, I do think I fulfilled that role as at home as well. I think also I was hugely influenced very early on by a couple of people, Sir Michael Balcombe and particularly Richard Attenborough, Dickie Attenborough. And I saw the way that they operated across the industry as they understood it was a whole industry. And they understood that their role within that industry was more than just making the individual movies. It was actually helping to hold the structure together so that the way in which films got made, the marketplace for films, the financial and political environment in which films were made was, you know, not just considered but nurtured. And I think I took that role on pretty early on. I was chairman of my section of the union in the mid-70s. I was only, what, in my 30s. Mm. And that was tough, but I learned a lot. I learned that, you know, that films are made by a lot of people. And that if you don't take account of the quality, for example, of your focus puller in those days, you can have a film that's out of focus. It's not a very good idea. So I think I had understood quite early on that the role played by every single person on a movie at a certain moment during the production was critical.
And presumably because anybody from a gaffer to a focus puller to your leading actor and your director, if they're in a bad mood, if they're not happy at work, a lot of work can go down the pan because of them not wanting to cooperate in the machine that you've made there.
Very, very much so. I mean, I remember an interesting moment on Chariots of Fire where it was going kind of well. It was not an easy film. We didn't really have enough money. And one of the riggers came up to me and said, oh, he said, I think you've got a good one here, Governor. Yeah. I said, oh, really? Why'd you say his name is Johnny? Why'd you say that, Johnny? He said, I've had this feeling before. He said, I had this feeling on Man for All Seasons where you kind of felt it was coming together and you were proud
not
of what you were doing.
Not a bad vibe.
Not a bad vibe. So what was amazing, so this is a rigger who'd picked up this in week four, you know, and you think, you know what, there is a chemistry. There is such a thing as a chemistry and there is such a thing as an environment people respond to.
And is that, in a way, the acid test, David, when a rigger comes up to you and says, you know, I've got a good feeling about this. Yeah. Is it, do you know that you've got something to slightly cajole, you've got to provide a carrot and a stick for this project now because it is something that exists, it is something precious, that the people working on it are invested in it wholly and emotionally as well?
I think that's very, very true. The other thing is, if you're smart, you get the sense that you're getting the breaks. By that I mean, you know, weather, for example. You know, weather is a constant issue. If you're getting those breaks, you begin to think that, as it were, the gods of film, we used to talk about the gods of film, are smiling down on you. You know, that's a significant thing. The other thing I learned, I worked early on with Ken Russell, and I learned one interesting thing from Ken. He was a very, very professional filmmaker. I mean, I don't like all of his movies, but he was an interesting man. I learned from him. He used to intelligently ask the crew what they thought of things. And if someone came up with an idea and said, you know, well, Gov, have you ever thought about doing this? Ken would do it. Mm. And I said to him once, you know, you're very, very good about following all that up. He said, look, sometimes I know it's a bad idea, but it's more important that they feel invested in the film. And if it takes me 10 minutes to do it, it's time well spent.
Yeah, and that's presumably one of the things. And how do you, as a producer on these big productions, as we said, we've mentioned some of those there, people will know that hundreds, thousands of people involved in putting these films together. How do you have to be an autocrat, or do you make a point of going around and asking people's opinion and making people happy? And can you do that and also seem kind of kosher rather than seem like you're faking it, I wonder?
I'd like to think the latter. You know, I started my career in advertising, and the purpose of being an account executive in an advertising agency was to have clients feel valued and have clients come to trust you. That's an important element. I tell you the thing I did used to try and do quite consciously, possible to suggest is slightly cynical. I try and make people feel a bit more valued than they normally expected to be. For example, I remember that we had a lot of problems on Chariots of Fire where we had insufficient extras, and in a sense we were asking a lot of them. And I think I arbitrarily upped their money, and I made absolutely sure that the food and the coffee and tea available to them. I really went out of my way to do that. And I knew that they knew I'd gone out of my way. And then you can ask that bit extra because, as I said, we didn't have enough of them, and we were really asking them to cover a lot of ground as extras.
Run a bit faster.
Run a bit faster, appear a bit more often, put different hats on.
Yeah, yeah, exactly. Everyone loves a crowd scene. Come on. Well, let's talk about some of these things. As I say, we have so much ground to cover, David, but we are in the rich world of film at the moment. Something like Chariots of Fire or something like The Mission, again, absolutely fantastic. Very moving movie in that same sense as Chariots of Fire. What happens at the beginning? Do you have a script? Do you have a chat with someone? Is it the back of a fag packet kind of story arc? Where do these things that are part of, as I say, the universal consciousness of film now, where do they start off?
It is a bit of the back of the fag packet because they start off as a kind of an idea. But there's a very good piece by Steve Johnson, you can get it on YouTube, about where do ideas come from. And what he suggests, and he's absolutely right, is they don't come from a single source. They're actually a collage of ideas that you may well have accumulated over a number of years. And Chariots is a brilliant example of that. As a kid, I used to read a lot of comics. I was not an academic child at all, but I read a lot of comics. And I had a hero called Alf Tupper, Tupper the Track, who was in the Beano and eventually in other things, Hotspur. And he was an important figure to me. He was a working class hero, brilliant runner, and he would go out and defeat the boys from Eton and Harrow and everything.
Yeah.
So I loved Alf. A few years after that, in 64, the first Olympics that was ever televised was the Tokyo Olympiad. And there was an amazing race in it by this very beautiful woman called Anne Packer. And Anne won the 800 metres gold medal in a most extraordinary race, in the most extraordinary, improbable way, coming from the back in the last 600 yards. And I remembered that, and she was engaged to a guy called Robbie Brightwell, who was the England captain. It was a rather romantic story. And she was a school teacher, so it was a pure amateurist thing. Then in 78, I read just a paragraph in a book on the Olympic Games about this man, Eric Liddell, who I'd never heard of, and this extraordinary thing that he refused to run on a Sunday. Actually, the paragraph itself was slightly inaccurate, which was helpful. And I suddenly, what I kind of pulled together was the Anne Packer story, the Alf Tupper story, and Liddell, and then I discovered that Liddell had these other compatriots, Harold Abrams, etc. And out of all that, I went to Colin Welland, who I knew, and I liked his writing, and said, look, and kind of dumped it on his desk. I said, look, there is something here, Colin. And back to Man for All Seasons, in a way, I think I'd always looked for a film where the hero figure had done something utterly improbable. I remember coming out of Man for All Seasons thinking, yeah, well, I wouldn't have signed that thing. I'd rather have a head cut off. And then you go around the corner, have a coffee, and think, well, that's daft.
Yeah.
So how do you do a film
that
while you're watching it, you think, yeah, you know, that's fantastic. And that's what Eric offered. Eric, it was particularly a film. For me, it was a film about Eric Liddell, this guy who didn't do the thing he trained for and worked for and was a superb athlete. But the way that the fates conspired, he was able to actually end up winning a gold medal and, in fact, even breaking the world record, as did Anne Packer.
As you say, watching the Tokyo Olympics and, you know, finding these newspaper stories and then possibly your own upbringing as well. There is a bit of, don't know whether it's a moral drive, but there is something that links a lot of your films together that is about the good guy triumphing and people triumphing against the odds and all the rest of it. I wonder whether you felt that you did that because, you know, the film industry, you maybe in a sense you're Alf Tupper and you're beating the boys from Eton and Harrow. You know, I'm sure that's crossed your mind before. Is it how
many,
true
many
is
times?
That?
There's two elements to that. Not the first, and most, and in a sense, most important is my father. My father was a journalist. I didn't meet him until I was 5 years old. He was away in the war as a war photographer. And my father was a very remarkable man. In most particular situation, he always used the word fair. Everything in my dad's world could be reduced to what was fair and what was right. He had an absolute laser sense rightness, mm-hmm. right. That would be one. And then I think, honestly, the media environment of the 1950s, which was aspirational. I mean, the movies were, the newspapers were. People forget the Daily Mirror was a campaigning newspaper to help the so-called working classes improve their literacy, improve their understanding of world and domestic events. I mean, in a way that, that's why I actually get very angry, in the way that today's media should be utterly ashamed of themselves. Mm. No attempts made to actually get people to feel that they're elevating themselves. In fact, we do the opposite. The current press, it might not right across the board, but certainly the tabloids, play to lowest common denominator. The result is we have a society that is that lowest common denominator in many, many respects.
I know that your most recent piece of work is to deliver a paper on public service broadcasting. These things are not distant cousins. These are brother and sister, it seems to me, these concerns of yours, actually, that this whole thing is intricately tied up. And it also reminds me of the spirit and the story of some of the films that you've made as well, that there is an idea of betterment, of improvement. Do you use the same bit of your brain, the same bit of passion and energy, I wonder, for delivering papers on public service broadcasting and caring about how the media covers life-changing topics, as you do to putting these sometimes rightly moralistic films together?
Probably, I think, is the answer. I think the only talent I have is my brain connects sometimes quite disparate things. I'm quite good at putting the dotted lines in and saying, yeah, you know what, actually that isn't that different from that. I mean, one of my constant issues with the film industry has always been that you're one industry. Will you stop talking about what's good for exhibition or what's good for distribution? Truth is, if either of those strands of the film industry collapse, the other one suffers grievously. Mm. So I think I've been very good at seeing things holistically, very good, quite good, and as I say, and joining the dots. And the other thing I'm proud of, when I look back, and it's got a long way to look back, and I'm 75, I think that genuinely for the last, since I was 25, I think my views have been pretty consistent, or certainly where those views have come from, and trying to enable those views to find outlets, as that makes sense. Yeah. So public service broadcasting is an obvious one, completely obvious outlet, because it's all of a piece with the way I saw the Daily Mirror trying to improve, not the lot of, but the aspirations of working class Brits in the 1950s. It was an active thing. The Cudlitz, one was the journalist, one was the editor, were trying to change things. Dennis Foreman and the Bernsteins at Granada Television were trying to change things. Hugh Carlton Green, the BBC, the director general of BBC, was trying to change things. These men were builders. They were builders. What I see now are people who, yes, are trying to build commercial enterprises and try to improve, if you like, shareholder value even. But I don't think they have a clue about how to build a society that's coherent and cohesive. Not a clue. And my biggest concern, I'm not even sure they have that much interest. You know, the Brexit, I'm still in mourning over Brexit because I don't think people fully understand the ramifications of it. We talk about, you know, we've got to in terms of society. First of all, I've spent 20 years at the House of Lords working with civil servants. For the most part, they are sensationally good. These are really good people. So the concept of public service is not lost in Britain. These are very, very good people. The tragedy is that in a lazy way, we allowed people wanted to exploit commerce and in a sense exploit disharmony to create this ridiculous parody of Europe. No, I worked within Europe. What I used to read was a Monty Python version.
Yeah.
It was never had any basis of reality. But fools like me, instead of very actively challenging it, shrugged it off and said, well, I actually know the reality. I'll just soldier on with the reality. Unfortunately, that parody became for many, many people the reality. And many of the people who voted for Brexit didn't have, and I'm not sorry to insult them, didn't have a clue of what the European Union was bringing to their lives and salvaging for their lives. You know, I was born in a war. The idea that war is impossible is a ludicrous thought. All of us need to spend a lot of our time protecting democracy, understanding the complexity of democracy, and understanding that the triumph of the last 60, 70 years is the avoidance of war.
And I know that you made some comments recently about how the BBC covered the Brexit debate. And as you say, maybe the general public, therefore the viewers and listeners, weren't armed with the sufficient facts to make an enlightened decision on the matter. There is a fact about bias, and this is an interesting thing, that you can be a film producer, you can have a career as a hugely successful film career, making up stories. but you can't do that when you are the national broadcaster. And neither can you give those made-up stories credence. And tell our listeners a little bit about that idea of bias. That I suppose it's, if 98 people say one thing and they're largely considered right, but two people say the other thing, the BBC has to give them half the airtime. What on earth is going on?
Well, it's ludicrous. I mean, it's patently ludicrous. We fought the battle, took a long time, about 3 years, over climate change for the BBC, where then for a long while the BBC felt they had to give the climate deniers equal time with the scientists making the case for science. They've, to their credit, realised that if 97% of the scientists in the world say one thing and 3% say something else, you don't have to give them equal time. By all means, every now and then create an opportunity for people who argue the consensus. But there is a consensus. It's rather like, you know, we still talk about Darwin and the theory of evolution. Is it really a theory? I mean, at what point has it really become an established? We accept that it's an established fact. And we don't tend to give a lot of airtime to people who argue with the theory of evolution. What happened over Brexit was tragic. For some extraordinary reason, and you might be able to find this out because I can't, the standards required of the Advertising Standards Association, ASA, do not apply to politics. Therefore, there is no obligation in politics to truth check. The BBC did have a truth checker eventually, but it was only online, wasn't it? It didn't seem to apply to off-air.
And this was a big red battle bus for...
So the big red battle bus, if you and I had been flogging a product, taking it around the country, we'd have been in serious trouble for propagating a lie. Unfortunately, this stuff falls out with the ASA. So the BBC was having to pretend that lies had some sort of credibility. The most interesting moment is a brilliant interview that Andrew Marr gave the Sunday after Brexit with Michael Gove, where he demolished him. He demolished him out of his own words. Andrew was never given permission. I haven't spoken to him about this, but you got the sense Andrew was never given permission to do his proper job.
During the campaign.
Right. Now, to have a public service broadcaster not able to challenge and actually expose nonsense was ridiculous.
And I know you said this when you received the BAFTA fellowship years ago, and you said this in your acceptance speech of that award, that you found that there was no dichotomy between informing and entertaining, which was one of Lord Reith's two of his three precepts for the BBC, I suppose. This kind of comes back to that, I feel, that a broadcaster that puts on EastEnders and entertains people and Strictly Come Dancing and all the rest of it also has a responsibility, whether it's the 6 o'clock news or whether it's The World at One on Radio 4 in a more serious news programme, doesn't lose sight of the fact that it is in business to do both of those two things. Is that something that you've been interested in and has been a hobby horse of yours in terms of putting together a paper on public service broadcasting to make sure that people know that the BBC and that other broadcasters have that liability to inform and entertain?
Well, you know, I did not intend to sound self-congratulatory. I think that the reason I was asked to chair that commission on the public service broadcasting is because people's feel that my own views are well enough established and that I was someone they could be trusted to actually come up with some answers that were not necessarily highly prejudiced. So I think that's part of it. The answer to that question is quite tough. I think, I may regret saying this, I don't like lazy films. You can make a thoroughly entertaining film, but if at no point in making that film you question, you know, what's the impact of this on the audience? Is there something I can tuck into this film that's got some real value in it, that's got something to say? That sounds to me like a really good idea. A very good example, I suppose, would be The Archers. The Archers is consistently extraordinarily successful. And yet within it is contained a huge amount of information about the agricultural world, about, you know, have you filled in that form, Fred? That stuff's in there. And the writers are good enough to be able to tuck it in there and play it as part of the drama without it sounding, you know, heavy-handed and finger-wagging. So the programme itself has got a purpose as well as being entertaining. What I've always tried to do in my own work is just that. Why am I making this film? When the audience walk out of my movies, and it doesn't always work, across the foyer, what have they learned about themselves? Are they feeling better about themselves? Are they feeling that the world has got more potential in it? Do they feel good about tomorrow, about getting up tomorrow, going to work tomorrow? That seems to me to be absolutely fundamental to my job as a filmmaker. It's not different from my job as a filmmaker. So if I did a film that was purely a piece of entertainment, yeah, it might make a fortune. But would I be satisfied? Not really.
To take it back to film then, David, before we finish, Are you interested in, you know these films have entered people's lives, they've entered slang, you know, they've become part of the patchwork of film. Have you ever sneaked into a cinema while something's been on to see what people's reaction is? You go through such an editing process, as you say, you're the daddy of the film in the first place. It goes through so many changes and cuts and bits and bobs. You go to premieres, there's all sorts of schmoozing to be done. Have you ever just sort of snuck into your local cinema and got into the back row to see what the punters think?
It would be, well, it's embarrassing me to tell you how often. I mean, at the period when I was knocking out really about a film a year, they used to play often at the Odeon Haymarket. I like the Odeon Haymarket. I like the size of it. And I'd go in almost every night, honestly. And I'd stand at the back left, at just an angle to the screen, quite important. So you get a sense of both the audience and the screen. And it's a sort of magic experience. There's two things I'd say. Anywhere you go in the world, people end up laughing, maybe at different volumes, at exactly the same things. That's why I actually love people and believe in people. People are not that different. But the best example is the following. In The Killing Fields, there's a moment towards the end where the child, Dith Pran, has been trying to save him, played by Hangnoir, and the child gets hit by a fragment grenade. They tread on it, and the child evidentially dies. It's very nicely, it's very, very well handled in the movie. And there's a kind of delayed reaction. And I could almost count like a conductor. One, two, three. And what would happen is in the cinema, there's a shimmer. Shh, like that. What is that shimmer? That shimmer is people's tears hitting the tops of their cheeks and reflecting back onto the screen. And it happened at the same moment, no matter where I was in the world, exactly. So what that tells you is the movie has penetrated people's emotions in an identical way, at an identical moment, for identical reason. Then you know you succeeded.
It gives you quite a lot of responsibility as a filmmaker.
Massive, massive, massive.
And you retired from filmmaking. I know that you're now working as you're exec producing documentaries. They're quite different worlds. Are you interested in telling stories in a different way? Do you feel that the film industry has changed, that maybe documentaries have more of a relevance? You can be campaigning with a small c in documentaries where you no longer can in theatrical filmmaking.
What happened? I actually started off in documentaries. What's happened is the DVD and the Blu-ray and online have given you a whole new marketplace for documentaries. So you're actually able to do things and say things where there wasn't a market for them. I mean, you could
make like in a very good place with documentaries.
Yeah, I think documentaries. I'd see as many documentaries nowadays as I see fiction films. But what I have been doing, I've been turning what was a documentary, which is the story of the Arctic 30, the Greenpeace protesters. I've been seeing if I can turn that into a compelling feature film by just messing a bit with the story, keeping all the essentials, all the essential truths, but attaching to it a character who the audience can identify with and live there and live that existence. Now, it's what it is. It's quite dangerous and it may not work. It is a mixing of two disciplines. If we pull it off, I think it could be remarkable, and I think it could actually be a presage a different type of cinema. But anyway, I've been working on that for about a year and a half. I guess over one more year, I'll see if I can make this work. And who knows, I may even end up having my name on the screen again.
That's still presumably an amazing thrill. Is that, will you still sneak into the back row of the Haymarket Odeon?
I certainly will do if it happens. if only the Haymarket Odeon was still there.
Well, indeed.
No, I absolutely will. I mean, I'm not doing this for vainglorious reasons. I'm doing it because it's a story. I'm very, very committed to climate change issues. I was fortunate enough to chair the climate change committee that saw the world's first Climate Change Act enabled in legislation. It will be the biggest single issue I'm going to leave to my children, grandchildren, and it would be nice to think I've done a movie that was relevant to my concerns.
It seems like there is a career rich in movies that were relevant to your concerns and to, luckily, millions of people around the world as well. Thank you for trying to distill it into 30 or 40 minutes. Lord David Putnam, thank you very much. You've been listening to The Big Interview with me, Robert Bound, in conversation with David Lord Putnam. The Big Interview is produced by Bill Lutie, researched by Gaia Lutz, and edited by Claire Crofton. Until next time, all that's left to say is thanks for tuning in.